Casey Spirituality Center presents Muffin Talk with Beate. Kia ora and welcome to our Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is brought to you by the Mercy Spirituality Center in Ipsum. We are a center for retreats, spiritual guidance, Christian meditation and personal development. Once a week, I invite a visitor to join me in the studio to talk about our center, our programs, about social justice or about the Catholic Church. With this Muffin Talk, I would like to thank all of you who are tuning into this program this year. And thank you to all my interview guests who accepted my invitation to come to the studio this year. Today, I would like to recall some highlights of our programs for 2018, the year we named the Year of Connectedness. If you would like to know the name of the speakers or the topics of each snippet, please check out our website or Facebook page. And our website is www.mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. Here we go.
It's actually the week of prayer for Christian unity, and it started with a group of people in the States who wanted to start to pray for Christian unity, and eventually it got taken on by the World Council of Churches, and the World Council of Churches started to promote it, and after the Vatican Council, the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity became a partner with the World Council of Churches, and they took on the organisation of the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. Now, in the Southern Hemisphere, those dates don't work because everybody out here is on holiday. So, mostly, it's celebrated the week before Pentecost and finishes on Pentecost Sunday, which is the birthday of the church, so it's an appropriate day for it.
Yeah.
And so, in New Zealand, we've always held it in that week.
And who organised it? You say the World Council of Christians?
The World Council of Churches and the Pontifical Council for Promotion of Christian Unity, the two bodies, oversee it. But in the last 30 years, they have delegated one particular country to actually come up with the theme. So I don't know how they choose the country, but anyway, a country chooses a theme, and usually it's relevant to its own history or its own celebrations or a significant thing. We've got to the stage of doing lots of things together and of accepting lots of things, like we accept one another's baptisms. But the two sticking points are how do we view Eucharist and ordination. So those are the two sticking points. And there's another sticking point now, which is causing quite a bit of division among the churches themselves, and that's how to deal with our gender issue.
Don Bosco was an amazing saint. I loved him very much. In fact, I worked in the society that he formed for nearly 42 years. Yeah, I felt that he was chosen by God to reach out to the poor and abandoned boys who had come in search of jobs in the city. He also reached out to the boys in prison due to petty crimes. Don Bosco realized that they were victims of the circumstances of his time. The Industrial Revolution had driven many of these boys to the cities in search of jobs. But with a lack of proper home and care, they were helpless. And hence Don Bosco took it upon himself to care for these poor and neglected boys. His insights into youth ministry are very remarkable. They can be used for successful parenting even in our days. Like, for example, he said, love what the boys love and the boys will love what you love. That is an amazing thing. So, in fact, Don Bosco loved a lot of games, a lot of music, a lot of outings, because he knew the boys could be attracted with all this. And that is why the boys loved him very much. And in fact, in return, they gave back to Don Bosco what he needed. They studied well. They really were obedient to the superiors. They were obedient to Don Bosco himself, and they loved him to the end. Don Bosco admired Saint Francis of Sales because of his docility, and he saw Saint Francis de Sales as a person who would be the best example for his Salesians, because we need a lot of patience, a lot of kindness, a lot of caring attitude towards the ones we are working with. And Don Bosco saw the attitude and the entire way that St. Francis de Sales went as the way that Don Bosco's followers should follow. And that is why he even chose the name Salesians. And that's why we are not called Don Boscos, Don Boscoites or anything, but we are called Salesians of Don Bosco, the followers of St. Francis of Sales in his way of dealing with others.
The problem about nightmares is that they are dreams. They wake you at a point of horror or terror when you feel helpless to know how you can prevent something dreadful happening. And that is often based on past experience, often early in your life, but maybe later, because terrible things happen to grown-ups too. Now, the point about nightmares is that they wake you before you have a chance to figure out how to survive. And basically, there was one theory about nightmares that they began way, way back in our early development as a contributor to our survival by replaying traumatic incidents so that we have a chance to figure out in the safety of our own dream life, what you could do to save yourself if the same sort of thing happened again. And so the proper response to a nightmare, having, let's say, been wakened by it and been frightened, is when you have calmed down, probably the next day, that you sit down and think about it in terms of the story of the nightmare and figure out what you could do to help yourself survive the survival challenges. How are we going to do it? Sometimes it is because we have been through awful experiences which have historically happened, but the response that our minds have to traumatic events is to kind of repeat them and repeat them. They come again like aftershocks, like the aftershocks of an earthquake, for example. Your mind still has the aftershocks of that event. Now, what you can't change is the historical event that first happened. What you can change is the way it affects you afterwards. Almost every discipline in the human arts and sciences, I mean, has come through a dream. Albert Einstein's formula for E=mc² was directly brought to his consciousness by a dozing state of mind.
There's a number of things we've been doing. The whole setup was around having a woman's haven, so that was the whole setup of the facilities. We are at Ellerslie in Umeda Street. And then prior to that is we had a footprint, I like to say, in Glen Innes for a long period of time, which is really where Te Waipuna Pōhewai started, which was in Waddell Street, which is still there. And our sisters still stay in the front there as part of being the people over 30 years knocking on doors and understanding that particular community. And so one of the things within Sisters of Mercy is they've got one of their symbols is the boots. And one of the things that they carried on was that tradition to walk the streets to meet the community. So after being invited in, they said, well, the only way we're going to meet the community is to go out there and knock on the door and say, hello, I'm Sister this, and make those contacts. So I go backwards to come forward because the services that come out as a result of that means it's been on a long journey. So so it was all focused towards women and children and support of families. In today's context, is around programs and services.
Bill said that he is a very strong advocate for community development. In a way, we've been talking about that when you said you're listening to the people and then you're helping them to find the solutions that they were looking for, or part of the solutions, a way where they can find them.
Yeah. So community is very important because it's the basis of how we exist within a wider group. And the particular community we deal with is called Tamaki in its wider sense, but that comprises of the towns of Glen Innes, Point England and Pamure in the main. But it's geographically within that area where we do our best work.
How I got involved with Te Waipuna Pōhewai was through my mother. So as a child I was, you know, faced with a lot of abuse in my life and sexual abuse, drugs and alcohol, and that was basically my childhood. And think about 2015, 2015, my mum was going through struggles as well, and she was receiving help from Te Wapuna Pūai through a woman named Sister Marie. And Sister Marie helped out so much and was, she asked my mum if she wanted help. Mum said yes, and so my mum went off to do some courses, some managing emotion courses, and then seeing my mum change from just doing the courses and doing a couple of other course programs and that to do with health and well-being and that, I said, oh, who's Te Wapuna Pūai? I want to do that. And then so I wanted a change and I needed to heal and feel loved and that. So I asked mum, oh, can you put me in contact with Te Wapuna Pūai? And she did. So I went through a process of going through a social worker who basically assessed me and my needs and heard my story, and I felt heard. And she said, okay, well, we've got these perfect courses for you. Like, you got managing emotion, conscious parenting. I did counselling for a couple of years and that. And it's been such a long journey, and that it's, you know, it was such a roller coaster for me. And I really do thank Te Wapuna Pūai for helping me in that journey and giving me an opportunity to even now work for Te Wapuna Pūai, because I was administrator, assistant, and I've just been going up, further up, and I don't want to stop.
St. Matthew is named both apostle and evangelist. Does this make him even more special?
I don't think, I wouldn't put it that way, no. I'd say he's one of the unique characters, in a sense, of the first century, because he's writing from his own perspective, and that then makes him somewhat special. But I would think that he has a skill that compares with the skill of Luke, but they're really writing for different audiences. And therefore, you can see what's happening in the early church as each of these individuals works with people and then proclaims the message and sort of defines the message for them. They have a different style and a different set of stories, a different set of expressions and creedal statements that they're going to rely upon. So that would be my response, really.
So St. Matthew, who was he? Is this the same St. Matthew, the tax collector, who was eager to meet Jesus and invite him into his house? Was it the same person, the St. Matthew the evangelist?
This is the big question, of course, for biblical scholars. The debates around Matthew have gone on for a number of years in the modern biblical critical world. So therefore, there is a sense whereby you'd say, well, perhaps if he's one of these Galilean personalities, that is from the north of the Holy Land, and he's a fisherman or a type like that, or comes from that sort of background, perhaps he wouldn't be quite as skilled as an author. And so you'd probably make a distinction about the apostle, strictly speaking, and then the evangelist. But I think in the tradition, we've added another title into the picture, and I think you might have mentioned it before in the opening to today, that I would put three titles alongside his name: tax collector, apostle, and evangelist. And the way the church then remembers the person called Matthew is to play upon that threefold sense, if you like. And the idea is then that when we look back at the history books, as it were, we find very little information about a number of the early church members. And Matthew is a typical character from the early church that we know little of.
Can we say that Matthew, as he was preaching to Jewish people and they knew the Torah, the five books of Moses,
exactly,
he would relate Jesus constantly to the Torah and would take it as a proof. See, this is what happened with Jesus. This is what the Torah said. And to convince them, Jesus is the Messiah.
That's right. And this is why when you look at the real way in which he writes his gospel, you get a feel for him at the same time. But he's using phrases constantly that say, as it is written, which means that it's the word of God, or as Jesus finished these words, he said something or other, you know. And then also you've got another thing then that this was to fulfill the law, what the Lord had spoken. And I think when you keep getting that echo effect through the gospel, you know that he's always looking back to the Torah in particular and to what has been taught there. And then when you listen to Jesus in Matthew's record of those teachings, everyone says, yes, this is the good news fulfilled. This is what Moses was really on about. He was waiting for the day when the Messiah, or what we say in Greek terms, the Christ, was going to come and do. And so that's why the fulfillment thing is a major idea that Matthew runs with constantly.
Catherine, so you're the convener of this committee, and that is focusing on the protection of life, as you said, from its conception to natural death. Yet you're specialized on post-abortion counseling. This means counseling for women who have already had an abortion. Can you tell us more about your work as a counselor?
Well, very often, in fact, most times, the women who come are actually suicidal. And many of them would have spent years trying to figure out what's at the bottom of their heartache. But we have to understand that obviously we want to protect every single life. And that includes all of the human living people. And all of those women who have been wounded by abortions and their families, their extended families, their grandparents, their parents, the fathers, those people, they have a need to grieve. And society just doesn't allow them that space. And it's remarkable. I've seen women grieving a five-week-old fetus just as if it was a five-year-old child, you know. And they just need time. They need love, and they need time, and they need to know that that it's important, that their grief is important and their child was important. And it's about bringing them to reconciliation, to forgive all those people who have hurt them, to bring them right through that grief stages. There's a lot of anger often, and bring them through to forgiving them those other people, often the doctors and the medical staff, and then finally forgiving themselves. Because if they don't forgive themselves, they go through life still damaged and hurting. That grief is still very much the same. That grief is so deep. And it's very difficult for the families, for the mothers who've not been involved in the abortion decision, to see their daughters' lives ruined. And they know that they would have helped the child if they'd been given the opportunity, you know. And often, the most often thing I hear is, nobody believed in me. Nobody said I could do it. Nobody believed that they could be a mother, you know, which is an incredible wound to your motherhood, to your essence of womanliness. Yeah.
And they might not have talked to many people during their decision.
No, they don't. Often they are so ashamed. Yeah, that's right. They're so ashamed they don't go and talk. And what we do know from pregnancy counselling services and other services like that if women are given impartial counselling, they will, about two-thirds of them, from wanting to seek an abortion, will change their mind if they're talking to someone who isn't buying into the decision. So it's not maybe their mother, it's not their husband or their boyfriend, but they're just given space to look at the alternatives. Their families deserve to know that, you know, if their 18-year-old daughter's going to have an abortion, she's about 7 times more likely to die of suicide in the next year, or 14 times more likely to die of homicide than if she'd carried that baby. Taking it into the Health Act, you know, if they took it into the Health Act, really they should be bringing in true informed consent. And all over the world, wherever they bring in informed consent laws, the abortion numbers drop immensely, because when people actually know the damage that it does, they actually don't want it. And I personally think if people saw what I see of abortion, they would never advise it for their girlfriends or their daughters or their wives. they just wouldn't inflict that kind of thing on someone when they know the long-term impact. But unfortunately, it happens and people panic and they see it as the only option. They really do. Most people think it's the only thing I could do. You know, I had no other choice. And it's completely contrary to what they're told. You know, it's meant to be choice, but it's completely not choice. Yeah.
And it's an emotionally difficult situation.
It's a very emotionally difficult time for them. Their hormones are already going crazy just because it's pregnancy. You know, and they need to be able to give in time.
But then again, if the impact of emotion is so strong, that's when we need a good law where we can protect the woman, really, because she will need good consultants.
Exactly, and it is about protecting them, and it's the whole of society, really, because it impacts, you know. It really, truly does. It impacts the grandparents. There's a lot of evidence now that it impacts the children of the aborted woman.
How important do you think is spirituality in a person's life?
Well, it is widely important, but today the society is being missing this. I can't accuse the individual, any persons, because of the vast majority of the education system, media, and certain type of understanding, it's fluxing and pump up the secular lifestyle more important than to some other important things. So any individual under these circumstances, it's difficult to understand spirituality. But the spirituality... sometimes you don't need to be measured. Just a couple of minutes of the dark room or dark sky, you can feel it. It's screaming your inside. Today's society is big missing, and that's why the many young generations, they try to settle it or stop it. They're screaming through the usage of the substance or doing some nonsense. That spirituality, it's really screaming inside every individual that says, feed me, understand me, and communicate to me. But we don't know the language or communication or connectedness of the spirituality of ourselves in a spectrum. We try to solve the problem outer world. And that's to create the more problem. Like the people are thirsty, need to be drink the water to satisfy the thirstiness. We do more the drinking the salt water. What the secular, I don't blame the society, but the society is bringing to today's individuals such enormous situations. The spiritual lifestyle is being screaming, feed me, understand me, communicate me. Instead, we just ignore it and give into more the materialistic type of lifestyle.
Brother Kieran, our church here starts on the 1st of Advent and we are entering the so-called liturgical year C. What does this mean for us?
Well, the focus is on the Gospel of Luke. So year A is Matthew, year B is Mark, year C is Luke. And, of course, in the liturgy of the Sundays, the Gospel is followed through, and then a reading from the Hebrew Scriptures or from Paul accompanies the Gospel. And the focus of the homilist is to draw out the connections. I feel a great sympathy for those who do the readings when they prepare the reading and it just remains uncommented on. It just drops into the silence. And my real concern is, I think the greatest neglect at the level of homilies is a complete unawareness of the Hebrew Scriptures. We can focus on the past with the birth of Jesus. We can focus on the future with all that interesting language about the end times using apocalyptic about the sun losing its light and the moon turning to blood and the waters, there'll be storms and earthquakes and goodness knows what. All the language of apocalyptic. But I think a really important coming is, how does the Lord come to us today, in the present time? And the reason why I think this is such an exciting year, the Gospel of Luke is such a beautiful gospel that it touches every aspect of our own lives, of our relationship with God. And, you know, this is sort of my favorite line about the presence of the Lord in His Word is as real as His Eucharist. If any gospel gives us the person of Jesus and the nature of God, then it is this Gospel of Luke, this beautiful gospel.
I'd have to say that Catherine McCauley, for me, having been to Baggot Street and seen the environment that she created, is not a historic figure anymore, because it was an abstract, the whole exercise was an abstract exercise. When you're actually, it was like teaching in a rote system as opposed to immersion. So now, for me, Catherine McCauley, and more importantly, the sisters as a whole, are a living thing. She was quite a pragmatist, a realist, and she wrote some pretty bad poetry.
What do you mean bad? It's bad in poetry or criticizing people?
No, she just used to, I think that was her way of stress relief. She would just write these little ditties, which are just hilarious, just to let some steam off.
Yeah.
I think one of the main lessons I learned there was the fact that she was also surrounded by quite incredible people that made her who she was, and her life experiences, living where she grew up, basically adopted and looking after a household in Coolock House, and learning to deal with servants and their problems in quite a big household. I think that's what prepared her to be able to deal with a diverse range of people.
I hope you enjoyed this review of the 2018 Muffin Talks and to hear some of our highlights. Please listen again to Muffin Talk in 2019, get inspired and informed by my interview guests, and hear what is coming up in our Mercy Spirituality Center. Please remember that our office will be closed until we resume on the 14th of January. For any requests, you may still like to contact us at info@mercyspiritualitycenter.org.nz. Those of you who are on our mailing list will have received our new program booklet for 2019. Our theme is gratitude. We have put together an interesting and diverse program. If you haven't received the booklet and it is not displayed in your parish, please send us an email and we'll send one to you. You might want to consider registering for our February programs already. On Saturday, the 16th of February, from 9:30 to 3:30 p.m., we have Sarah Cooper, who will facilitate a retreat day with the title Rediscovering Wholeness of Life in Christ, How Gratitude Opens the Way. 1 week later, we will offer a morning with Father Chris Skinner, who will share and teach a number of his musical settings to the Psalms with the theme of gratitude. This music workshop will take place at St. Columba Center in Vermont Street, Ponsonby, on Saturday the 23rd of February from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And on the 22nd and 23rd February 2019, also Margaret Bowater will come to our Mercy Spirituality Center and facilitate an introduction to dream work. I wish you all a very happy new year 2019, and I hope you tune in again.